Good day and welcome to yet another terrific example of us showing more interest in the continent than too many of the mainstream media people. But we're thrilled because we also have the man who is the name that we need in this business. Africa Analysis is brought to you every 2 weeks by none other than the Johannesburg Business School. And we're in the capable hands this week, as ever, of JJ Cornish. Jean-Jacques, how nice to see you.
Great to be with you. Great to be with you.
So, the United Nations, of course, a very important organization, increasingly important in everyone's lives, gathered, and there was a General Assembly, which was terrific because every president no one can name from every small and indistinct, unimportant country which affects the world, just about 0.0005%, all got up and had a chance to talk and to moan and to complain and to say why everybody else is so unfair. But there is an absolute move in a certain direction there, which I'd like you to comment on, because there's something that you know about this that very many of us do not, and it involves a Northern African neighbor of ours, and this is the Decolonization Committee of the UN. Let it never be said that they're not an ideological organization. So what does this Decolonization Committee do?
Well, you know, the UN General Assembly is still very much on. What got the attention of the world, and then it just dwindled straight after that, is the world affairs debate. And that goes on for 2 weeks. It's just finished. They have the General Assembly will last all the way now till December and make sorts of resolutions, none of which have any muscle whatever. But they have the six committees, and the fourth committee is the Decolonization Committee. And once upon a time, Namibia was on that, and I covered five General Assemblies, and we used to sit in that hall, which is next to the Security Council, very big hall, and listen to what was happening. There were three issues at that time, major issues: Western Sahara, East Timor, and Namibia. And I, in my wisdom, told of the assembled journalistic or this assembled hacks, guys, listen to me. Well, all of my 25 years of accumulated wisdom, the Polisario Front in Western Sahara has kicked the bejesus out of the Mauritanians because what happened was Western Sahara, when Franco died, the Western Sahara, the colony of Spanish Sahara, they just abandoned it. That's what the Spaniards did. They were not the world's best colonialists, it has to be said, because in fact, they're still responsible in terms of UN for what is happening there. Anyway, Polisario kicked Mauritania out within a matter of weeks. Morocco simply moved in on the territory that they'd taken. But I said, there's no doubt they're the most doughty fighters. They will get their independence first. Secondly, I'm not sure about East Timor. That I admitted not being sure about something was very unlike me at the time. Not sure about East Timor, but I can assure you guys sitting here now in front of me that the Boers will never, ever give up Namibia in our lifetime. And it's like when you go to a wine tasting and you're 100% wrong, you start to think, maybe I'm not an onophile and maybe I'm not a forecaster or a predictor of what is happening in international terms, because Namibia was free within a year of that, and East Timor within about 3 years of that, and the Polisario is still fighting, and they seem to be having a tough time because France and Spain, well, in fact, not France, but Emmanuel Macron, without a government, so he personally. And then the Spanish, Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish premier, they have both said, well, Morocco's plan for a settlement seems to make sense. And effectively, Polisario fought an 11-year war with Morocco. They fought themselves to a standstill. A ceasefire was achieved on the basis that there would be a referendum in the Western Sahara. But immediately the ceasefire took effect. Morocco reneged on that, which is not uncharacteristic. You know, I refer to Morocco as the new apartheid South Africa, because they don't give a bugger for what world international opinion is. They simply, with the backing of a superpower, we had all three superpowers backing us at the time, were all three permanent members, indeed, Britain, France, and the United States. They've certainly got France all the way. And they just don't, they keep on with a with a very dastardly colonialization of Western Sahara, calling it Spanish Sahara, Moroccan Sahara at the time. But the most important development now is the European Court of Justice ruled on Friday that Morocco has absolutely no legal hold on Western Sahara, that Polisario is the authentic representative of the people of that country, and that all arrangements that Morocco has had to sell Sahrawi goods, that's the fish off the sea and the stuff off the land and the stuff under the land, the phosphate, is null and void and in fact illegal. And they are breaching the right of the people to Western Sahara to self-determination by carrying out these deeds. Another thing they're doing is selling prime seafront properties to people in the Emirates and the Arab states. All of these are now illegal. Now, it's interesting. Maybe some other people in the world could try and ignore that, but certainly France and Spain are going to have to think again about claiming to or trying to give any sovereignty claim or recognition to Morocco. So it really has cut them off at the knees too in terms of this whatever drove them to it. And other countries that might be thinking to do the same, I think Denmark is one of those. There's countries like Portugal and others that have said, well, we want to, we still want to maintain good relations. And Polisario says, well, of course you want to maintain good relations with Morocco. That's your perfect right. But don't come, pirating the goods of the Western Sahara, and don't try to claim that they have any kind of sovereignty. Holland, Italy, are much in the same boat, moving towards the Moroccan position. But as Europeans, they now are going to have to accept that after 8 years of litigation, first went to the General Court of Europe and they ruled that Morocco has no hold. Morocco mm-hmm. appealed it. It went to mm-hmm. the appeal court and they ruled too, no hold. So finally they went to the top body, which is the European Court of Justice, and there's no appeal against it. And the European Court of Justice has said that this major political implications, as I say, in terms of recognizing their sovereignty. And there's also, economic relations because implications, because they no longer can loot and pillage the goods of Western Sahara. And these countries have to recognize, according to the International Court of Justice, that the people have a right to self-determination. And that's the way the world is going to have to move.
Gifts for irony in the fact that some European court has the last say about an issue between Morocco and Western Sahara. But we'll leave the word decolonization on the table. Otherwise, it gives some people no way to keep on grifting at the UN. What I am pleased about here is that it seems to me like the good guys have won. Certainly based on what you've been telling us over the last couple of years in African analysis. But what is the South African government's position on Morocco and the Western Sahara? Do we have one? Is it clear from our international relations?
I'm proud to say very, very strongly. But they took their good time. I was going to say goddamn time, but I'm not going to use that kind of language on this program. They took their time. You know that Madiba promised Western Sahara, we're in this fight together. When we get independence, or when we get come to power, we will recognize you. And it took them a couple of years to do it. But once they did it in spades. And mm-hmm. I would say that in Africa, Nigeria and South Africa are the two strongest supporters of Western Sahara. In fact, South Africa opposed Morocco being allowed into the African Union. Morocco stormed out of the Organization of African Unity when it recognized the Western Sahara, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, stormed mm-hmm. out and stayed out. And in the interim, then, of course, the OAU dissolved and became the African Union, and Morocco wasn't in it. And Morocco, with their policy of just telling flat-out lies. It was like Ian Smith from Rhodesia, pathological liar, and other politicians operating today, but let me not get into that. Just lying flat-out. They said, we've been excluded from the African Union. Well, they were never excluded. They had walked out, and the African Union had reformed. So it took them some years. They've come back, and South Africa voted against it, but they did manage to get a slim majority come in, and they are there. but they still have to deal then with Western Sahara as a fellow member, in fact, as a founder member of the African Union.
So, I mean, a rare moment on African Analysis where we can hand our international relations department a little bouquet for standing up for something and being a stalwart supporter of that thing, even if it's a thing that Morocco doesn't like.
Absolutely. Morocco withdrew their ambassador from here. And then I think they have got a new ambassador back. I remember him well. I was speaking, invited to a function, speaking from the dais, and I mentioned my belief that Morocco has become the new apartheid South Africa, and mentioning things like in the war against Western Sahara, they were armed by apartheid South Africa. I've seen the weapons, or captured weapons. And the ambassador, God bless him, walked up to the dais, stood beneath me, shook his little finger, P.W. Buerta style, and said, "Menteur, menteur," which means liar, liar. And I said, "Mr. Ambassador, is that how they teach you in diplomat school in Rabat?" Some of his friends got up, realizing that he was humiliating himself, and led him from the building. So I have an interesting background with these Moroccans. Interestingly, you know, this decolonization committee, which you would think, and there's only 17 issues before it now, that, you know, that things would start slowing down. They have an unprecedented 250 speakers before them in this session, which will last this week and go into next for a bit if necessary. 150 of those 250 are for Western Sahara. So it's going to be a very interesting session to be at.
Yeah, well, I'm not just going to give a bouquet to the International Relations Department of our government, but I'll say to you as well. I mean, it's a rare thing for principled journalists these days to stand up at events where they know they'll meet with some opposition, and you had the ambassador right there in front of you, and you said what you understood to be the truth. I love it. So thank you, JJ. It's one of the reasons we like having you here. So that's quite a complicated situation for some people who've maybe never heard of the Western Sahara before. But let's just talk about a country that's not too far from there, Tunisia, because Kais Saied is expected to be announced the winner of yesterday's presidential election. That is a Sunday in Tunisia, the presidential election there. The opponents of this increasingly despotic academic have been either prevented from running or jailed. Oh, no. Another story of an unfair, unfree election. Ugh.
You know, they had Bourguiba, the president, and then he lost his marbles, not to put too fine a point to it. And his interior minister, when you have an oppressive country, the interior minister has to be the bad guy because he has his hands on the cops and things like that. Right. Ben Ali, he took over. It was effectively a bloodless coup. He took it over. And Ben Ali ran it for maybe 30 years. And it was a beastly country in a sense that, I mean, they had very good diplomats. I got to know them fairly well, visiting Algeria and Morocco and Western Sahara. I went through Tunisia, and the initial ambassador, Marco Boni, from South African ambassador, is a good friend of mine. So I always went and stayed with him. And then the Tunisians invited me and took me to show me how, in fact, they had taught the world how far apart they should plant their olive trees to get maximum yield and things like that. And there was a cop on every single corner and every single motorway outlet. And I said to my host, my Tunisian host, but this is, and in every railway carriage, this is a police state, isn't it? And he looked at me with pride and said, yes. How do you think we keep ourselves, you know, a little country sandwiched in between Libya and Algeria? How do you think we keep ourselves safe if we were not? Well, so it's in a troubled part of the world. But Tunisia, of course, was the birthplace of the Arab Spring in 2011. And, right. You know, they had treated this fishmonger very, very badly, and greengrocer and fishmonger, and he committed suicide. And then the people railed against it. Then Tunisia won a Nobel Prize. The interim government won a Nobel Prize for bringing peace to the country. And then in 2019, I went there as an observer and saw Kais Saied, a very shy academic sort of fellow, becoming the president, elected president. But within 2 years, he dissolved parliament and started ruling like a despot. And I just wonder what it is about the Tunisians that they should attract this kind of despotism. And he's there. He had two opponents. They disallowed another three. And he had two opponents, one of whom was actually jailed at the time. And the other opponent, you know, won something like 2% of the vote, because he won, what is the figure that he's claiming? Quite an amazing figure, something like... it's in the 90s. Well, but they have a 28% turnout, so he's got a massive vote for him, and it's pretty sad that
it's like Vladimir Putin, hugely popular. They always get these incredible scores. It's just great.
Yeah, I've seen one president claim 101%. So I mean, you know, they kind of lose it completely when they've lost it. But it's sad to see, because Tunisia is a wonderful country, and it's just, you know, just the other side of the Mediterranean. You can see Sicily from the northernmost point of Tunisia. And so the Europeans looking for affordable holidays, because it was always quite affordable, even for South Africans, would go there. And places like Sidi Bou Said, absolutely beautiful, a town painted with azure blue windows, roofs, and then white walls. Absolutely gorgeous to be there. And so they would rely on their tourism as one of the big foreign currency earners. Yep. But then they've had three or four bad terrorism attacks. And now, of course, with Kais Saied behaving the way he does, you know, the tourism has fallen off again. And that is, you know, really been a body blow to the Tunisians.
Well, of course, it's the site of old Carthage, the great enemy of ancient Rome.
Yes.
And there are some spectacular Roman ruins in Tunisia. Some would say better than any you'll find in Italy.
Well, I've rumbled around those ruins a good bit, and they are very, very impressive. And they also developed a health tourism industry, you know, and then down the way they went. If you were an aging guy with a problem, or an aging gal with a problem for that matter, you could go to Tunisia and be put up in a very, very special clinic and looked after in that way. But as I say, once the terrorism emerged, very nasty terrorism, and aimed mostly at Western visitors or European visitors, that all fell off. So they were just picking up, and, you know, with a proper election of Kais Saied, nobody doubted his election in 2019. Things were starting to look up, and I sort of prayed for Tunisia, because, as I say, the Tunisians I know from the first ambassador that they had here, I was very, very fond of, and I loved the country. But to see what is happening there now is heartbreaking.
JJ, let's go from one autocratic dictator to another. This guy's been enthroned for a while longer than Kais Saied. He's well known. That is Erdogan of Turkey, and Turkiye, as people are now calling it, you know, when it becomes fashionable for people to pretend that they know about the country by pronouncing things like Kiev instead of Kiev, or Turkiye instead of Turkey. It's like when people who are not French say, Paris, I'm going to Paris, and you want to correct them and say, no, there is an English word for that. Anyway, Turkiye is becoming increasingly interested in the affairs of Somalia. And this is curious to me, because Somalia is not the sort of country that very many people are interested in, except that they want to avoid it, particularly if you're in the business of shipping.
Well, Turkey, of course, is a NATO power, so you know, and it feels that it has an arm into Africa. So you know, look at the countries that are really, really interested in Africa: the United States, Russia, China, Britain, France, and Turkey, Japan. You know, all of which have big seminars and gatherings. Turkey is now becoming one of those countries, and for somehow or another, picked on the very difficult Somalia. And they've been there for some time. You know, the Turks look after the wastewater management, the garbage disposal. They're now starting to search for oil and gas off the wealthy coast, Red Sea coast of Somalia. And they will get a third of the profits that they're going to make from it. But we have this naval ship going, and they're going to re-equip, and they're going to enforce, and they're going to train the Navy in Somalia. So they recognize the dangers. Well, they're not the only ones. I mean, France has recognized the dangers in many of the countries that it colonialized or took control of or had relations with, they've been hoofed out of most of those now. But Turkey is doing the best it can. And Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he was the first non-African leader to visit Somalia in more than 20 years.
I mean, let's again, you know, if we're going to name quite rightly French and British and other European colonial powers, we have to remember that the Ottoman Empire, which existed and held sway from Turkey, its capital was Istanbul for many years, that Ottoman Empire was also the owner and ruler of Egypt, Syria, much of Lebanon, even parts of what we today call Saudi Arabia, Jordan. All of those countries belonged once to the empire and colonial power of the Ottoman Turks.
And you still get sort of old-fashioned Turks talking about being Ottomans, you know. It truly is a country I've visited a number of times, but not nearly widely enough. They have enormous offers, and I don't know if you've been watching on television, they are boosting the Turkish tourism industry fiercely, and you know, I mean, it's one of those countries that I'd love to return to, but they do have, I mean, our very good Turkish friends here who are all in exile, and then I've been to Turkey on the back of that, or paid for by that cleric, you know, who is in United States and opposes Erdogan. But, you know, then they play things out. The huge mosque between you and I in Midrand is run by a guy who is on the side of the cleric opposing Erdogan. And so, you know, where they play. The Turks are very, very big on the building industry. So if you get a Turkish presence in a country, You believe that they would be in building, just as if you got Italians, you'd believe they'd be in food and in restaurants and that sort of thing. So they have a lot to offer, a huge bit, and certainly a country on its knees like Somalia, they have a great deal to offer. They made these agreements, they signed agreements some months ago, and now Turkey's making good on them.
Well, why shouldn't they? I mean, if no one else is prepared to help Somalia and Turkey wants a third of the profits from any oil or gas they discover offshore. I mean, who's stupid enough to think that there are countries in the world which are dealing with the treasuries that are provided them by their citizens and or slaves in some cases, because some of these countries don't necessarily impress you as democracies. Who would think, in all the possible ignorance that you can muster, that countries act altruistically? I mean, there's got to be a cut for them somewhere. And if Turkey's going to get their piece of the pie this way and it'll help poor, broken Somalia to regain some sort of semblance of order, whether it's wastewater production facilities or construction, then God bless them, right?
Absolutely. You know, the basic tenet of diplomacy is that you do not have friends, you have interests. And if you see your interest in working that way, then God bless you. I know the Chinese, for example, are accused of neo-colonialism. And the Chinese ambassador here, second Chinese ambassador here, who became a vice minister of foreign affairs, invited me to China. And he was a fantastic guy with lovely evenings of joking, and he very, very in on South African politics. But he said, isn't it supremely ironic that the very countries who accuse us of being neo-colonialists are the countries that know about colonialism very well, because they're the actual colonialists. Many of them hoofed out at that time.
Well, I don't know. It seems that we have a little hypocrisy, which wouldn't be the first time that we've encountered that in an episode of African Analysis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, we live in by hypocrisy and double standards. And, you know, it's almost boring to break into a sentence and call something a double standard, because that's what it is. And not only did we deal with hypocrisy and double standards today, we've dealt with rank outright lies. And if you want to try and run the world properly, that's what you've got to do, and learn to know those, to spot those, and to deal with them.
I think it's always very interesting to hear your point of view on these things, because at least you know some of the characters intimately involved in making those decisions, and you bring us facts and figures and all kinds of interesting stuff that we wouldn't have known otherwise. So, JJ, it's always valuable to spend time with you, and I thank you for your time. this week on Africanalysis. It's brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School, and we will return with another episode before you even noticed.